This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for a Monday, March 1st, 2021. Here are some of your headlines. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas saying immigrant families who were separated at the border by the Donald Trump administration will have the option of being reunified either in their country of origin or in the United States. Johnson & Johnson starts shipping its newly approved coronavirus vaccine. The CEO predicting the first shots will be in arms in 1 or 2 days. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer promising the Senate will take up this week the $1.9 trillion coronavirus aid package. House passed its version early Saturday morning. It's looking like a minimum wage increase, though, is off the table for a final bill. This is after the Senate parliamentarian ruled it violates Senate budgeting rules. Question is now, in the Senate, what else may get dropped? Senate Judiciary Committee approving the nomination of Merrick Garland for Attorney General. The vote was 15-7, sending it to the full Senate for a final confirmation vote. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi joining the list of some prominent Democrats calling the sexual harassment allegations against New York Governor Andrew Cuomo by two former female employees credible and supporting an independent investigation into his behavior. And we begin with immigration policy. During the Trump administration, about 2,800 migrant families were separated at the border. This was in 2018. About 550 children have not yet been reunited with their parents. The current Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas saying the Biden administration has brought 105 families together so far. But he also says it's going to take some time to undo what the previous administration did.
We are dedicated to achieving and, quite frankly, are working around the clock to replace the cruelty of the past administration with an orderly, humane, and safe immigration process. It is hard, and it will take time. But rest assured, we are going to get it done. Let me explain to you why it is hard and why it is going to take time. I think it is important to understand what we have inherited because it defines the situation as it currently stands. Entire systems are not rebuilt in a day or in a few weeks. To put it succinctly, the prior administration dismantled our nation's immigration system in its entirety. When I started 27 days ago, I learned that we did not have the facilities available or equipped to administer the humanitarian laws that our Congress passed years ago. We did not have the personnel, policies, procedures, or training to administer those laws. Quite frankly, the entire system was gutted.
Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. President Joe Biden created a task force that's focused on immigrant family reunification. Secretary said today where the families are brought back together is going to be their choice.
Finally, let me turn to, I think, the most powerful and heartbreaking example of the cruelty that preceded this administration, and that is the intentional separation of children from their parents. I am the chairman. I have the privilege of serving at the president's designation as the chairman of the Family Reunification Task Force. The First Lady has driven us to action through her personal commitment to this moral imperative. And that moral imperative is to reunite the families and restore them to the fullest capacity that we as a United States government can do. And I should say that we are not doing it alone. We are working closely with counsel for the separated family members. We are doing it along with the countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. I spoke with the foreign minister of each of those countries this past Friday. We are doing it with non-governmental organizations, and we intend to and will shortly harness the capabilities, resources, and desire of the private sector. This is not only an all of government, but all of society effort to do what is right. We are hoping to reunite the families either here or in the country of origin. We hope to be in a position to give them the election. And if, in fact, they seek to reunite here in the United States, we will explore lawful pathways for them to remain in the United States and to address the family needs, so we are acting as restoratively as possible.
The Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas at the White House in the briefing room today. NBC News reports the reunification task force from the Biden administration will be working with non-governmental organizations as well as the countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Other benefits and protections the task force will give the separated families include transportation, health care, and mental health services, as well as legal, career, and educational services with no cost being passed down to the families. And a DHS spokesperson saying the task force will also consider siblings of children separated for reunification. President Joe Biden today holding a virtual meeting with the president of Mexico, Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador. And President Biden during the virtual meeting, the Mexican president proposing a new immigrant labor program modeled on the one after World War II called Bracero, from the Spanish word for manual labor. It was done after World War II to fill labor shortages in the U.S. This new one being proposed by the Mexican president could bring up to 800,000 Mexican and Central American immigrants per year to work legally in the U.S., not only in the agriculture fields, but other sectors and professions as well. Turning to the coronavirus, the first doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine just approved this weekend for emergency use, boxed and shipped today from the company's distribution facility in Shepherdsville, Kentucky. First doses heading for Ohio and Indiana. The CEO of J&J, Alex Gorsky, was on ABC's Good Morning America.
You're shipping out about 4 million doses this month, and that's shy of the 12 million that you expected to have at the end of February. What went wrong there?
Well, George, let's just step back for a moment. First of all, for the last 13 months, our physicians, our scientists, our engineers have been working around the clock to make this day possible. And following the FDA and the CDC's recommendation for approval over the last couple days, this really brings together a tremendous amount of work to have a safe, effective vaccine with a single dose on a not-for-profit basis, standard refrigeration, out again in millions of doses within the first several days, and we'll have 100 million doses available by June. So we couldn't be more excited. I don't believe that we've ever been able to produce that many doses of a vaccine, let alone any medicine, in that kind of time in history. So we're incredibly proud of what we've been able to do, and we couldn't be more excited.
So even though you're not meeting this February goal, you still expect to have the 12 million by the end of March and the 20 million later this spring?
Well, actually, we anticipate March or shipping 4 million over the next several days. We then expect to have about 20 million having been delivered by March. And then we'll be on this path to do 100 million by June of this year. And remember, that's all en route to doing almost a billion doses over the course of 2021. And what's really important here, George, is when I say 100 million in the first half of the year, that's 100 million shots in arms for Americans and even more for people around the world.
Johnson & Johnson CEO Alex Gorsky on ABC's Good Morning America Monday morning. CNBC reporting U.S. stocks jumped sharply on Monday in a broad-based rally as stocks tied to the economic reopening jumped on vaccine optimism, while tech names rebounded from steep losses last week. Dow Jones Industrial Average up 603, NASDAQ up 396, S&P up 90. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine has some advantages over the other two approved vaccines in the U.S. from Pfizer and Moderna. J&J only requires one dose and can be stored at regular refrigerator temperatures instead of needing to be super cooled. Dr. Marcella Nunez-Smith, the Health Equity Chair on the White House COVID-19 response team, elaborating today during the virtual briefing held by the White House.
You know, all three vaccines are safe and highly effective at preventing what we care about most, and that's very serious illness and death. So all of the authorized vaccines will be distributed across states and jurisdictions and across all of our federal vaccination channels. That doesn't mean that every vaccination site will have every vaccine, but it means that all vaccines will reach all communities. So all three authorized vaccines available in the suburbs, all three available in the cities, all three available on the coast and in the heartland. So I just want to briefly talk about some of the clinical benefits of the J&J vaccine from a healthcare provider's perspective. You know, having these different types of vaccines available for use, you know, ones that have different storage requirements, different handling requirements, different dosing recommendations, that will bring more options and more flexibility to healthcare providers. You know, it could absolutely allow for expanded availability of vaccine, you know, in some temporary clinics, some pop-up mobile sites, and those locations that do not have cold storage capacity. Overall, increased vaccine supply creates greater opportunity for people to get vaccinated. We also recognize some individuals may have a preference for a single dose vaccine. So those who do not want to return for a second dose or who would have difficulty returning for a second dose. And we understand that. Still, as a physician, I strongly urge everyone in America to get the first vaccine that is available to you when it is your turn. If people want to opt for one vaccine over another, you know, they may have to wait. Time is of the essence. Getting vaccinated saves lives. No doubt, communities across the country have been devastated by this pandemic. The vaccines and vaccinations are a critical tool in bringing this unprecedented pandemic to an end. And now we have three. And so for that, in addition to the scientists, I want to thank all of the clinical trial participants for their contributions to scientific discovery. You know, for this vaccination campaign to be successful, vaccines will have to reach everyone. And so kudos to those states and jurisdictions who are already working closely with trusted leaders in the hardest hit communities to ensure fair and equitable access to vaccinations. This is best practice. So again, all three vaccines have been proven safe, highly effective at preventing severe disease, hospitalization, and death from COVID-19 after full immunity. And if I could leave people with one message, it is this: get vaccinated with the first vaccine available to you. Protect yourself, your family, and your community from COVID-19.
Dr. Marcella Nunez-Smith is Health Equity Chair with the White House COVID-19 Response Team. President Biden has been looking to federally run mass vaccination sites to help get more shots in arms faster, and the U.S. military playing a critical role to help run them. Joining us now with more on this is Megan Myers, Pentagon Bureau Chief at Military Times. Thanks so much for doing this. You were recently at the mass vaccination site in Los Angeles. What did you find?
So the site in LA is the first of about a dozen that are in progress or about to be stood up across the country. And they've been open for about a week when I was there, and they had roughly 200 active duty service members, but then there were also a number of California Army National and Air Guard there helping to do kind of the check-in and the check-out. And then there were active duty troops who were doing the actual shots and arms, medics mostly from Fort Carson, Colorado. And it was honestly pretty cool to see. They had it set up at Cal State Los Angeles in near the dorms in like the parking area. So the walk-up part was in, if you wanted to walk up and you didn't have a car, if you took public transportation or somebody dropped you off, they were in a parking garage and everything was kind of distance, and there was lines everywhere and you check in on an iPad. But then for Angelinos who have cars, which is a lot of them, also in the open air parking area, there were lanes where you basically pull up, you talk to some soldiers who check you in, make sure you have an appointment, and then they would drive through, they would go to the next station, get their shot, and then they would drive to the next station and sit there for at least 15 minutes if you didn't have any medical conditions, but up to 30 minutes if you did, just to make sure that there weren't any immediate medical emergencies. And then once that was done, you could just be on your way and you're vaccinated. And of course, they come back, you know, in 4 weeks, I guess, that they're giving the Pfizer vaccine there. You come back in a few weeks and get your second shot and you're good to go.
active military have been used in domestic situations in the past, I guess, especially natural disasters. But anything like this that's happened before?
Not that I'm aware of, but this past year, you know, troops have been called on for all sorts of things. And it's usually the National Guard. So there were, you know, quite a few National Guard members there. But to have active duty soldiers who would otherwise be working probably at a hospital, you know, back at their base, having them come down is a little unusual. But it's one of these situations where FEMA has asked DOD to help them with this. And for DOD, the easiest thing for them to do is to send some of their own medical personnel who would already be doing this full time back home if they weren't doing it elsewhere.
Now, FEMA originally wanted up to 100 sites. Will they get close to that?
It's possible. So right now they're kind of doing it in tranches. So after FEMA sent that request to the Pentagon said, okay, we'll do like the first 25. And as of last week, they've got like 11 that they've decided where they want to be. So basically FEMA at each point in this process sends another request to the Pentagon and says, hey, how about Texas? Hey, how about Florida? Which is where they're setting up now. So there's a possibility, and some of these troops have been told, you know, they could be doing this for much of the rest of the year. But right now they're kind of doing it in smaller slices, and 25 is the first authorization that FEMA and Northern Command are working on.
We're talking with Megan Myers of the Military Times. I was going to ask you whether these troops were getting any special training before being deployed to this mission, but you're saying most of them are in the medical field originally.
Yeah, so the active duty troops, the ones that I talked to, there was a group of just straight up Army medics who give vaccinations all the time from Fort Carson. And then there were a number of registered nurses who had volunteered, and they were from Texas, Hawaii, Washington State. And so they are all very well versed in how to give a vaccine and how to brief someone before they get it about the potential side effects and who to call if they feel like they're having side effects. So most of the kind of ironing out of the kinks was the actual sites and how they work and training not just the medical staff, but the guard troops there, how to bring people in, how to work the iPad and check them in, and then how the flow kind of works because you move throughout stations, everyone's wearing masks. If you're in the walk-up site, everything is very stretched out. There's lots of space for people. They have like a big area that's just folding chairs where you sit and wait to make sure that you don't have a reaction afterward. Or for a lot of people, they were very nervous or very anxious about getting the vaccine. And so they have a place to just kind of like gather themselves. If they're, you know, they're feeling short of breath, they can just sit and relax for a minute before they get back on the road.
Megan Myers, Pentagon Bureau Chief at Military Times. Read her stories at militarytimes.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Washington Today continues in a minute. And welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. A court in Paris finding former French President Nicolas Sarkozy guilty of corruption and influence peddling, sentencing him to 1 year in prison and a 2 year suspended sentence. It's the first time in France's modern history that a former president has been convicted of corruption. Sarkozy is 66 years old. He was president from 2007 through 2012. In the U.S., the Supreme Court agreeing to take a case on whether it is unconstitutional to exclude people living in Puerto Rico from SSI, Supplemental Social Security Income, the program that provides cash to older, disabled, and blind Americans in 50 states and District of Columbia. And California's public schools could get $6.6 billion from the state's legislature if they return to in-person instruction by the end of March. That according to a new agreement announced between Governor Gavin Newsom and the state's legislative leaders. California, the most populous U.S. state, has over 1,000 public school districts, more than 6 million students, over 300,000 teachers. It was after midnight Friday into Saturday morning when the U.S. House finally passed the $1.9 trillion coronavirus economic relief bill. Now it is in the Senate's hands. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer spoke about the path ahead.
The Senate will then return to the American Rescue Plan, comprehensive legislation that will help us crush the virus, recover our economy, and get life back to normal. Defeating the pandemic is national priority number one. Getting our schools to reopen as safely and quickly as possible, helping small businesses hang on until the economy can come roaring back, keeping teachers and firefighters and other essential employees on the job, providing aid to the jobless, food to the hungry, direct cash payments to millions of Americans struggling with the cost of rent, groceries, medicine, and utilities, speeding the distribution of the vaccine, which is the cornerstone to ending this awfully dark chapter in American history. That's what our country needs, and that's what the American Rescue Plan will achieve. To paraphrase Franklin Roosevelt, we must do the first things first. Last week, the legislation passed in the House of Representatives. This week, the Senate will take up the measure. Let me say that again. The Senate will take up the American Rescue Plan this week. I expect a hearty debate and some late nights, but the American people sent us here with a job to do, to help the country through this moment of extraordinary challenge, to end through action the greatest health crisis our country has faced in a century. And that's just what we're going to do.
The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor. Democrats say they want to get this aid bill signed into law by March 14th. That's when the current extension of the enhanced federal unemployment benefits expires. Senator Schumer followed by the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell saying that Republicans, by and large, will oppose this bill.
Now, another matter, at about 2 o'clock on Saturday morning, House Democrats rammed through the bonanza of partisan spending they're calling a pandemic rescue package. Only Democrats voted for it. Both Republicans and Democrats voted against it. Last year, under a Republican Senate and a Republican administration, Congress passed 5 historic coronavirus relief bills, 5 of them. Not one of the 5 bills got fewer than 90 votes in the Senate or less than about 80% over in the House. But alas, this time, Democrats have chosen to go a completely partisan route. Even famous liberal economists and liberal editorial boards are saying their half-baked plan is poorly targeted to what families need. So we've gone from passing COVID relief with 80% and 90% bipartisan supermajorities last year to the Speaker of the House ramming this through with just 50.7% of the House on Friday night. The bill contains all kinds of liberal spending on pet projects with no relationship whatsoever to pandemic relief. Now remember, we're almost to the 1-year anniversary of a leading House Democrat admitting they see this whole crisis as, quote, a tremendous opportunity to restructure things to fit our vision, end quote. So, sorry to all the American families who've just been hoping to get their jobs back, their schools back, and their lives back. Democrats are more interested in some restructuring. That's why only 1%, Madam President, 1% of this huge package goes directly to vaccinations. 1% for vaccinations. That's why it proposes another 12-digit sum of federal funding for K through 12 schools, even though science tells us schools can be made safe right now. About 95% of that funding won't even go out this fiscal year. 95% of the school funding in this bill won't go out this year.
The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor. The Majority Leader Chuck Schumer saying that bill could be on the floor by Wednesday. Between now and then, they're dealing with a number of cabinet nominations, including the Education Secretary nomination, Miguel Cardona, happening this Monday. You can always follow the Senate live, gavel to gavel, on C-SPAN 2 television, or listen on the free C-SPAN radio app. Just choose the C-SPAN 2 live stream. Back to this aid bill, this from The Hill newspaper. Senator Dick Durbin, the number 2 Senate Democrat, shooting down calls from progressives to overrule the chamber's parliamentarian and include a minimum wage hike in the $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief bill. Asked about talk of teaming up with Vice President Kamala Harris to overrule the parliamentarian, Elizabeth McDonough, Durbin said that Democrats should instead look for another piece of legislation to use as a vehicle for trying to increase the minimum wage. At the White House today, the press secretary, Jen Psaki, agreed.
On the parliamentarian decision, you said that he respects that decision, but progressives don't understand this. In some respect, they're like, why not fight for this? So why is the White House not more aggressively challenging that and sending the vice president to try and potentially overrule that with the vote?
Well, the decision for the vice president to vote to overrule or to take a step to overrule is not a simple decision. It would also require 50 votes. As you know, it's not a one-step decision. And the president and the vice president both respect the history of the Senate. They are both formerly served in the Senate, and that's not an action we intend to take. But the president is committed to raising the minimum wage, to working to determine the best vehicle forward to doing that. That's why he put it in the package. He wants it to be raised to $15 an hour, and he will be in touch with leaders from all wings of the party in determining the best path forward for that.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. An article in the Wall Street Journal begins, "A debate to raise the federal minimum wage has tied Congress in knots. But many large employers and business groups wouldn't mind an increase." Joining us now is one of the reporters who wrote that article, Eric Marath. Thanks so much for being with us. Why wouldn't they mind?
Yeah, so kind of the conventional wisdom is businesses are against a minimum wage. They don't want the government to tell them, how to pay their employees. But, that's changing. And I think a lot of it comes down to the minimum wage at a federal level hasn't been increased in 12 years. So some of them say, hey, it's time for a raise, and they'd like to have a voice in what that level is. But you're also seeing companies from Walmart to Costco to Amazon, who employ a lot of low-wage workers, raising their minimum wages, raising their starting wages. And in some ways, those businesses would like everyone else to have to follow the same rules.
What do they think of the proposed $15 an hour?
Yeah, $15 an hour doesn't have the same level of support. Some businesses, Amazon, probably the most notable, is lobbying for $15 minimum wage because they already start their workers at that level. A lot of other businesses are either agnostic to 15 or say that might be a bit too high, especially because they operate in lower cost areas of the country, including rural communities or the Deep South, where, the median wage is pretty close to $15 an hour.
We've been talking about large employers versus smaller employers. Would they have a different view on this?
Yeah, there's a lot more concern about the minimum wage increasing among smaller employers. The concern there is that they don't have the same sort of margins and bandwidth to spread across minimum wages. So if you have hundreds of thousands of hourly workers, maybe you just cut a half hour off their shifts, and that helps bring labor costs. But if you only have 5 or 10 people working at your store, that's a bigger adjustment. And restaurants in particular are concerned about a minimum wage increase because the proposal President Biden has put forth would eliminate a tipped minimum wage. So currently, tipped workers can be paid less than the full minimum wage so long as their tips make up the difference. President Biden's proposal would take that away. So no matter if you got a tip or not, you'd still need to be paid $15 an hour.
Whenever we hear this debate about the minimum wage, there appears to be some disagreement about some basic facts, like how many people work at the minimum wage and what effect it could have raising it on the economy. What are the facts on that?
Yeah, well, it's challenging to narrow that down. So in terms of how many people earn the federal minimum wage, it's very little. It's about 250,000 in an economy that employs 140 million workers, right? So a fraction of 1%. But many more people, the Congressional Budget Office estimates around 17 million people earn less than $15 an hour. So there's quite a number of people in that space. So that's where it's a little bit unclear. And then the effects of the minimum wage, that's challenging because there's not a lot of precedent for a doubling of the federal minimum wage, right? So we can study smaller minimum wage increases at states or in the country in the past, but it hasn't gone up as much as being proposed now. And so some economists say, that makes puts us in uncertain territory. That might cause job losses where a 50-cent increase, you know, maybe doesn't.
We're talking with Eric Morath with the Wall Street Journal. Some other proposals have been put out there, maybe having regional increases as opposed to a national increase. Any chance of that?
Well, in some ways, that's already happening. So 29 states have minimum wage above the federal level. Some of them, ranging from California to Florida, are on their way to a $15 an hour minimum wage. So we really already do have a patchwork, but that's not enforced at the federal level. So you're absolutely right. In Congress have floated the idea of having regional minimum wages or setting the minimum wage as a formula based on, say, average wages in the state. That could be a little bit tricky to enforce. I mean, one of the things that proponents of the minimum wage really like is that it's very easy to understand. This is the smallest amount I'm supposed to be paid, and if I'm not getting that, that's illegal, and I can report my employer to authorities. It's a little bit harder to say if every state, every county has a different wage, how that would be applied. And also another thing proponents bring up is that, you know, having a state-by-state system maybe allows a place like Alabama to have a lower minimum wage. But there are cities, including Philadelphia, Atlanta, Dallas. Those are big cities that aren't that cheap to live in, and they still follow a $7.25 minimum wage.
So we keep having these debates every year. Some have suggested just indexing the minimum wage to inflation. Could that happen?
Yeah, so that would be a part of the Biden proposal is to, once the level reaches 15, it would still continue to increase there, but at a much smaller amount based on how overall wages grow in the country. A lot of states have adopted that type of model. It's pretty common every January, about 20 states announce the minimum wage went up by a nickel or something of that nature. And a lot of economists, really on both sides of this debate, like that idea that they say it seems to be more jarring to businesses to maybe every 8 to 12 years have a big change in the policy, and then it might be easier to adapt to say, we've studied it, this is the level, and now let's just keep that level steady as prices go up.
Eric Morath is a labor economics and policy reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Read his work at WSJ.com. Thank you very much.
Sure. Happy to join you. Thanks for having me.
Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren introducing a bill today that she calls the Ultra Millionaires Tax Act to impose a new tax on assets of America's wealthiest people.
It is time for a wealth tax in America. I want to remind everybody what the wealth tax is. It is a tax on the fortunes above $50 million. In other words, your first $50 million is free and clear, but your 50 millionth and first dollar, you got to pay 2 cents. And 2 cents on every dollar after that until you hit a billion. When you hit a billion, you got to pay a few cents more. This is a wealth tax that has been needed for a long time. We need it to produce more revenue, to create more opportunity in America. But it is a wealth tax that we particularly need because of the changes in this country under the pandemic. We have watched the wealth of the billionaire class in America increase by more than $1 trillion over the last year. A 2 cent wealth tax would just help level the playing field a little bit and create the kind of revenue that would let us build back better, as Joe Biden says, would let us make the investments in our children, investments in infrastructure, investments in a clean economy, investments in America's future.
Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat from Massachusetts, on Capitol Hill. This proposal, similar to what she proposed when she ran for president. And she estimates it could raise $2.75 trillion over 10 years by taxing about 100,000 people. The recent frigid weather in Texas that led to massive power outages has now resulted in the largest and oldest electric power cooperative there, Brazos, filing for bankruptcy protection. Brazos citing a disputed $1.8 billion bill from the state's grid operator. Brazos was required, and others were as well, to buy replacement power at higher rates when it couldn't supply its own power. This is Washington Today. The Pentagon says the U.S. airstrike last week against militants in eastern Syria killed one fighter and wounded two others. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby also asked today about Israel's claim that Iran was behind an attack on an Israeli-owned freighter in the Gulf of Oman last week.
John, do you have any updated damage assessment from the airstrike last week in Syria, including civilian casualties that you referenced? And also a related question about the subsequent event in the Gulf of Oman, where Israel is now saying that Iran was responsible for that explosion aboard the ship. And I'm wondering whether the U.S. has any evidence to support the claim that Iran was responsible.
On the second question, Bob, I would point you to Israeli authorities to speak to that, since this ship belonged to them. I know they've already been out there on that. I don't have any intelligence assessments on that to speak to at the podium today. On the battle damage assessment, we've obviously seen a lot of reporting out there on numbers of casualties from Thursday's strike. What I can tell you is that we believe right now there was likely one militia member killed and two militia members wounded. And we'll continue to assess, as you know we do, and if that changes, we'll certainly let you know. But as of today, we assess one killed and two militia members wounded.
The Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, one of the monitoring groups that is coming up with a different estimate, it's based in London, says the U.S. raid killed at least 22 fighters. It was an airstrike against Iranian-backed militias, and the U.S. says in retaliation for deadly rocket attacks against U.S. bases in the area. White House today defending the administration's decision not to penalize Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in connection with the 2018 murder of U.S.-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi. This after a U.S. intelligence report released on Friday implicated MBS, as he's known, in that killing. A question to the White House press secretary today, Jen Psaki.
The president has not taken any direct action against the Saudi Crown Prince in response to his involvement in the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Why not? And what message is the president sending to autocrats around the world that they could kill journalists or their own citizens with impunity and not suffer personal sanctions?
Well, let me first say that, this was a horrific crime. The president has been consistent in reiterating that and his belief of that. The report that was released on Friday through ODNI did not contain new information. It was important to the president that it was released and it abided by our legal obligations. And it wasn't something that was done by the prior administration. We also took a series of strong steps to impose on individuals directly involved in the operation that led to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, including adding senior Saudi intelligence official Ahmed Al-Asiri to the list of those facing global Magnitsky designation. I don't know why that's a mouthful. We also sanctioned under the global Magnitsky rule the entire Rapid Intervention Force, a unit of the Saudi Royal Guard that has engaged in counter-dissident operations, including the operation that resulted in the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. This is a crucial step because it structurally addresses an unacceptable pattern of targeting, monitoring, harassment, and threats to dissidents and journalists. And we believe, our national security team believes, that going after the network responsible for these actions is the best way to prevent a crime like this from ever happening again. That is our objective.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. Saudi Arabia's UN ambassador tweeting today that the U.S. intelligence report, quote, is based on could've, should've, and would've, and does not rise to anywhere close to proving the accusation beyond reasonable doubt. The prince courageously accepted moral responsibility, presented the accused to the justice system, and pledged to reform the intelligence organizations. Case closed. Those tweets from Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the United Nations. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, held a news conference at the UN today, talking about the Biden administration's priorities as she settles into the job and the U.S. gets the United Nations Security Council presidency in the month of March.
And on the very first day he took office, President Biden took action to ensure America once again leads, as he put it, by the power of our example. We ended the Muslim ban. We launched a government-wide initiative to advance racial equity. We are protecting dreamers. We reversed the ban on transgender individuals serving in our military, and we restored our refugee admissions program. America is once again shining our light of liberty on those who need it most. We are recommitting to defending democracy and human rights across the board. And as part of that effort, President Biden will be hosting a global summit for democracy to renew the spirit and shared purpose of the nations of the free world. These actions not only reflect our values as Americans, they advance the security and the prosperity of Americans, as well as others around the world. By rejoining the WHO, we will work to stamp out the pandemic that has taken more American lives than the battlefields of World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam Wars combined. By rejoining the Paris Agreement, we're fighting against the devastating hurricanes, wildfires, blackouts, and storms that have destroyed the homes and lives of so many millions of our friends and neighbors. Of course, it's not just in our interest. It's also in the interest of our friends and our allies, and even those who aren't our friends around the world, because diplomacy is not a zero-sum game. Peace, progress, prosperity, and security serve us all. This is the spirit in which we approach our March presidency of the United Nations Security Council. America is back at the table, literally and figuratively. We are engaging in a way, in a very new way. March is Women's History Month, and we are proud to be co-sponsoring an ARIA formula meeting with Ireland, Mexico, Kenya, and Tunisia to call attention to the work that remains to be achieved on gender equity around the world. We will demand accountability for the rampant sexual exploitation and abuse that has increased during this pandemic. And we will complement the work of the UN Commission on the Status of Women.
The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, today at the UN in New York City. She also says that during the month of March, when the U.S. has the presidency of the Security Council, she plans to push for more intense discussions about Myanmar, whose elected civilian government was thrown out in a military coup last month. Well, thanks for joining us on Washington Today. It's available as a podcast wherever you get your podcast. You can subscribe so you don't miss one. And remember, you can listen anytime, anywhere on the free C-SPAN radio app. Wishing you a very good evening.